Learning the difficult grammar of Federal Reserve speak. From APM in New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update. The benchmark interest rate in America was higher early today than it was before the new chair of the Federal Reserve's briefing yesterday, 2.77 for the 10-year yield versus 2.67%. On Thursdays, we get our own briefing from Diane Swonk, chief economist at Mesirow Financial in Chicago. Morning, Diane.
Good morning.
So we were both there listening intently as the Fed chair spoke after the big meeting yesterday. Diane, did you hear Janet Yellen suggesting that interest rates might go up more quickly than you'd been thinking?
Yes and no, and that's the problem Janet Yellen is stuck with today, is that she said, don't look at these numbers, listen to what we say. And then she unfortunately said, after asked a question, what does it mean, considerable period of time, she said, oh, I don't know, you know, sort of kind of maybe 6 months, and that, two words, 6 months, and the market was unfortunately off to a very bad race.
And in fact, we have the 10-year yield up at 2.77% because of that utterance of the term 6 months. But it is a delicate dance, as you point out. The Fed wants to give itself wiggle room, but it also wants to explain its position.
It's really more of an art than a science. They're trying to give what they call forward guidance. They're trying to say, this is what we think we're going to do under these kinds of circumstances. And they're trying to give reassurances that they're not going to raise interest rates anytime soon. And more importantly, even when they do, they're not going to be aggressive about it, because they really want to make sure not only does this economy heal, but it has traction for the long haul. That was her endpoint message. That process and that path was a very convoluted path, unfortunately.
Diane Swonk at Mesirow Financial, thank you.
Thank you.
In a couple minutes, the Labor Department releases its yearly assessment of the job situation for military veterans. The jobless rate for vets who served after 9/11 tends to be higher than the overall unemployment rate. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports.
Companies love to run ads about supporting the troops, but former Army officer Derek Bennett of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America says that doesn't always mean hiring them.
Finding employment can be difficult. Translating what you've done in the military into something that is recognizable by an employer can be difficult as well.
Marine veteran Michael Wersan says combat experience is hard to explain on a resume.
Nobody cares that I did 700 patrols in 7 months. That doesn't compute for a civilian.
He's now a construction supervisor. Iraq veteran Tyreek Tulloch found job hunting frustrating at first.
I really couldn't get past a phone interview.
But he kept at it, and now works in network engineering. Apart from misunderstanding military skills, Derek Bennett says some employers misunderstand vets.
I think there's a lot of misconceptions that every veteran is a ticking time bomb.
Not all veterans have PTSD, and it's manageable. Vets want employers to look beyond stereotypes and do more to find the veterans who might have the skills they're looking for. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
It's been about 2.5 years since a 5.8 earthquake cracked the Washington Monument. It'll reopen in the coming weeks. Marketplace's David Gura now on how they paid for repairs.
Brian Hall is with the National Park Service.
We're looking up at the Washington Monument just to our north. Currently, it has scaffolding across the bottom 120 feet of it.
For several months, that scaffolding completely covered the monument, which is 555 feet 5 1/8 inches tall.
If you just had a high-powered lens on your camera or a set of binoculars to see up at the top, yes, there were some very visible cracks.
Examining and fixing more than 30,000 stones cost $15 million. But the government only paid half of that. The rest came from billionaire David Rubenstein.
Increasingly, I think people should give money to things that the federal government used to be able to do but probably can't do.
Rubenstein co-founded a private equity firm called the Carlyle Group, and he's given tens of millions of dollars to government institutions. Jim Ferris heads the Center on Philanthropy and Public Policy at USC. He says the wealthy used to shy away from this kind of philanthropy, but that is starting to change.
Increasingly, I think people see opportunities to actually work with government.
There's even a federal task force to encourage agencies to partner with donors.
The extent to which we're trying to ingrain it, institutionalize it, I think is new.
Today, there is a call for philanthropy to do more.
Gene Temple is the dean of the Lilly School of Philanthropy at Indiana University. He says that during the most recent government shutdown, hedge fund billionaire John Arnold and his wife Laura gave $10 million to Head Start to keep it from closing. Temple says philanthropists like Rubenstein and the Arnolds are doing noble work, but he says there could be a danger to this kind of giving.
And that is, the government can think that this is the way it has to be done.
Temple says we're not there yet. Indiana University keeps track of gifts worth $1 million or more, and so far, Temple says, less than 1% has gone to the government. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
And if authorities have it right, it was a case of insider trading like something out of Get Smart. Two financial players were busted in New York yesterday. They're allegedly part of a ring that exchanged info in ornate ways, such as clandestine meetings at Grand Central Terminal, and then eating, as in chewing and ingesting, the slips of paper on which stock tips were scribbled. They apparently also spoke in a little code that they worked out. One guy used to work at Morgan Stanley. The other was apparently trolling around the office computer at the fancy law firm of Simpson, Thatcher, and Bartlett, looking for hints about deals to come. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.